This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We Americans are focused on the important, and I have to say entertaining, presidential race underway in this country. The vote isn't until November, but emotions are already running high, and it's not surprising. Elections always evoke great hope and deep fear. But perhaps nowhere are those fears and hopes more pronounced than in Kenya. There's a presidential election slated for the end of the year, the first since a violent election in 2007 that shook the East African nation and shocked the world. Since then, Kenyans have put a new constitution in place. The hope is that the new framework will eliminate some of the problems that led to ethnic bloodshed 5 years ago. The fear is that old wounds haven't fully healed and could easily be reopened in this year's balloting. Billy Kahora is a Kenyan writer. He places his faith in the power of storytelling and literature. He wants to help Kenyans better explore their relationship with government and reimagine a national identity that includes a rich blend of ethnic differences. Billy is managing editor of Kwani. It's a literary network in Kenya that nurtures creative writing and a publishing industry to support it. I spoke with Billy a couple of years ago when I visited Nairobi. Now he's here in Durham to participate in a seminar at Duke University's Franklin Humanities Institute, and I'm happy to welcome him back to the State of Things. Billy Kahora, good to see you again.
Thanks, Frank. It's nice being here.
So how are people feeling in advance of this election? Are there fears that this will be a repeat of 2007?
I think there are about, let's say, several positions, maybe three. One thing that's been of major impact is the ICC hearings. Six people were actually taken to the International Court. This is in Hague,
mm-hmm.
and four of those are senior politicians and potential presidential candidates. This has been going on since mid last year.
And this is all the result of the violence of 2007.
Of the violence.
So there's some sense that there was accountability in this, that you can't just do it and get away with
precisely.
It.
Precisely. Now, once they started televising those hearings, and the attention all over the country was huge. The silences, the conversations, opinions, everywhere you went. And I think this being a judicial process, of course, in real time, slow kind of drags on, but just the sheer attention of that and just the understanding that it is actually possible to take some of these people to a place like that to be accountable is enough in itself. Now, next week they're going to announce whether these guys are going to be convicted or what's going to happen to those hearings. But what has happened so far is so momentous and is such a deterrent. So before anybody actually thinks, I've been joking with like some of my friends that anybody thinks of actually doing this, they'll probably like do it. It'll either happen in extreme. They'll actually wonder, is it worth it? Or they'll be like, how do I do it without getting caught or actually entering a space, this judicial space? So that's one big thing that's actually happened. I think that actually even kind of overtook what had been set up by the Constitution. I think what happened with the Constitution and how people are feeling about the elections and the fears and all the things you've mentioned were that the of course, constitution making is a highly technical, highly less publicized thing going on. I think the fact that that was passed had that huge mass appeal and excitement. And the technical, I don't think everyone's following the technical as much as they should, not from a mass, from a kind of mass orientation. But what's also happening is that there's some serious, serious mechanics that are being put into place. And though you don't realize it when it's actually being done, it actually starts spreading a kind of legitimacy and a kind of accountability.
Mm.
Last week, for example, Attorney General proposed is in the public because she's said to have harassed a security guard.
Mm.
This is something that would never happen in the past. There are all sorts of stories that appear from everywhere where you see some like anecdotes of justice that you never saw in Kenya. So like the groundwork for an elections that avoids violence has actually been put into place. It's not that nothing's been done, but the fears are always there. My personal opinion is this, is that The violence happened because of two unequal opposing factions who actually thought they could get away with some kind of impunity. What happens, I think the worst thing that could, I don't think there's a possibility of having these two equal forces again. Because what you're actually, in the weirdest way, and in the most general of ways, I would describe this as the state versus the people, quote unquote. So you had an incumbent president who had this, the state behind him, and then you had a group of politicians led by a very charismatic guy who seemed to have the people, quote unquote, which is halfway. So these people kind of meet in the middle, and that's what happens. What I don't think that will happen at a national level. Personally, I feel that there are places, and these places have always been frontiers of difference, including the Rift Valley, including the coast, that still have to iron out issues that might have that kind of thing. But the most, the thing to add is that some of these conflicts are not necessarily political. The economic, the socioeconomic, and the historical.
Well, and they're obviously exploited by people in power. It's very interesting that you would suggest that in the last election, it was the state versus a charismatic leader who nominally anyway represents the people.
Yeah.
You say that equation has changed somewhat. Is it because the power of the state has somewhat been diminished by the new constitution or just the dynamics of the personalities involved?
The last bit, but both, all of them, the guy who had the people, quote unquote, behind him has joined the state. So he'll probably be coming from the state. The opposing factions are also in the state. So what they'll probably be doing is now acting outside of that. It'd be interesting to see where the state in this kind of case, which really means the incumbent presidency, will lie. And that I think is being closely watched, because what one would hope for is for him to take a neutral position. So you have an open and free, fair playing ground. If the state decides to support a faction, it becomes problematic.
But the fact that, you pointed this out, that there are two kind of key areas of accountability, the international court and also the fact that there was a new constitution, a response to the violence, an official response, makes people think, well, we can't get away with it. We can't do things the way we did in the last. We can't even exploit the tensions and differences in the same way because we won't get away with it.
True.
So before the 07 vote, Kwani set up a series, and of course no one could see this coming. I mean, that was one of the more interesting and terrifying things about the violence, is that it wasn't predictable prior to the election. And Kwani set up a series of creative nonfiction workshops to train writers and journalists to reflect that election. What was your goal?
The goal was really to actually... I've always felt that the elections, every elections year is when you actually have the most interesting and most organic interaction between the state and its citizens. In fact, I think that's the only time. I think the Kenyans are usually subjects and have always been subjects when it comes to the successive regimes we've had. It's the first time you have a kind of almost equal interaction. You have these politicians who need something. Yeah, so they approach these people not with dictums, not with exhortations, but they come to ask and beg. And over time, people have become smart. So they say, if you want this, which is votes, we'll give you this. So when I joined Kwani and we were trying to actually just map, what are we going to be writing about? And we knew what we were going to write about because we felt there's a lot of stuff that was absent, just on paper and in text. Of all the things that jumped out, we always felt, and this was, everybody knows about elections, everyone knows about campaigns, everyone knows what happens on the ground. So when we set that out, we were like, we've never done an elections, and there are all these gaps. So what I've just mentioned about interaction between people and the state, and then just all the shenanigans that go on, the bribery, just the interesting dramas, this new enmities between people who never had problems with each other. So as a storyteller, it's just natural that this is a point of high drama. It's a crucible of a lot of stuff happening that heightens every other thing you see in Kenyan society in years that are not elections.
But you had some complaints along the way. You were getting questions like, well, how do you narrate an event like the election with fictive elements? I mean, how did you answer that going in?
What I would ask is, what do you think happens like now? election, for example, last week they announced our elections have been pushed further to 2013. So everyone takes a sigh of relief. This has been postponed for a while because a couple of things happen. First and foremost, it seems as if government stops providing services because all the politicians are running campaigns. Everyone's like talking about, oh, I've got to get that elections money. How am I going to get that elections money? So everyone kind of changes in their behavior and how they're doing things. And so what happens is that all this stuff that you're recording is what the writer does. Like, if you're going to be writing about Kenyan constantly, because all these things that are going on, the elections year is the best time to actually capture these things. So that's how you just basically answer that. But what we're specifically interested in is the politician's character. Because the way politicians have been portrayed basically in text are through sound bites, through caricatures, through the ways we know them. But these are also family people. These are somebody's brother. This is some guy who started off, who have these trajectories of rural to urban. And this is what stories do. But if you don't break down those people, you don't break down the people they're interacting with, how do you even start describing our society? And I think that's what stories do. That's how we look at it.
You are here now as part of a conversation at Duke's Franklin Humanities Institute, and it's called The Function of the Literary Magazine in the Current Movement. As far as Kwani is concerned, what is the function of Kwani as a literary magazine and a network?
I think we've done a couple of things, and I think that, especially just going back to elections, when you go to Kenya and you start thinking about what is the memory of elections, like I told you, political sound bites. You find all sorts of statistics to deal with constituencies. You get none of the story, like which everybody knows, everyone can observe. So the first thing we want to do is we are always interested in putting forward popular memory against official memory. We're also very interested in, I mean, people always say that literature kind of died in the 80s and the 90s. I don't think it did. I just think that creativity just found unstructured spaces. So we're very interested in actually now capturing all the creativity that's been there. People tell stories all the time, everywhere, when you go to church, when you go to the bars, when you go to the matatus. So Kwani is also interested. And I think what we've done is go to those spaces and see how can we put that stuff into text.
Because there's right now a very thin stratum that is reflected in literature, and in fact, literature appeals to a fairly narrow spectrum right now of readers. And so I take it that you're trying to broaden that, both in terms of the content and the readership.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people are being creative in all sorts of ways. So when you talk about literature, people think of literature with capital L. They think about, oh, the university. They think about big things. They think like, oh, I need to talk about the freedom fighter. Oh, I need to talk about the rural boy who was poor and now has become a rich politician. So people are always thinking theme with capital T. Whereas consistently, the stories are going on all the time. They're on FM radio. They're in cartoons. They're in church. They're all in these places. And what Kwani is interested in is yanking them out and saying, these things can actually be put on the page. Don't fear them. They're part of us. Let's put them on the page. Let's structure them as
so
we know them.
Give us an example. What's on the pages of the latest issue of Kwani?
We actually published a memo of a domestic servant. And the domestic servants are a huge, huge population in Kenya, underclass. You hardly ever saw them in print. You hardly ever saw them in text. So one thing we've published is a story of a domestic servant. Most domestic servants are just girls who can't, whose parents, rural peasants, who can't pay for their fees. When they finish primary school or even standard four, which is halfway, and they're about 12 years, they get traded off to like a middle class or a rich family, or not even to a poor family in Nairobi, and they're told you've got to go and fend for yourself. So we've actually like written about the travails of that. We've recently released a collaboration between writers and photographers of Nairobi as you never seen before. Ideas of Nairobi have always been this tourist city with lots of animals, savanna and all that, or developmental statistics coming from the UN or crime statistics. Well, like there are other things going on there. There's fashion, there's movement, there's food, there's spirituality, all these other things in between the spaces. We've just released that.
And it represents a vast majority of the activity. And I think you're about to publish a book or putting together a book by a matatu driver. These are the small vans that carry the vast majority of commuters in a city of 3 million people, and yet considered outlaws by almost everybody, including those of us who've almost been hit by them.
Yeah.
So tell us about that project.
There's this guy who's actually a graduate who couldn't find a job, so based on the socioeconomic conditions in Kenya. So he decides, well, I've got to survive, I've got to feed my kids, and he becomes a matatu driver. But he also has a bit more ambition, so he decides to actually form an association to actually legitimize matatu drivers. But he also starts a blog about being a matatu driver. And what's most interesting is that he's kind of conflict, I think, with the state here being the police, or like vigilante spaces, when he started to start a matatu association, which is something, of course, various forces are scared of, because matatu drivers are many. They have a lot of day-to-day influence. So we looked at his blog, and it's pretty interesting, and we're like, of all the matatus, so many things. I think it's the most public space in Kenya. It's a fashion space. It's an aesthetic space. It's a space of huge entrepreneurship. And you're just like, this guy really has something to say. This guy spends 6 days a week, and he spends 6 days a week over the last 10, 15 years transversing Nairobi. Who else knows as much about Nairobi as he does? And you'll never, ever find this kind of narratives anywhere.
And just to point out what the matatu is, they are fabulously painted, each one of them unique, music of all sorts blaring from them. They're packed with people from every social stratum in, except for, I suppose, the very highest, who are all packed in and on their way to and from, dozens of them at any given moment, at any given intersection, sometimes on the sidewalks and not. And the margins are very thin, so you have to be a very smart business person just to navigate. All of this stuff is happening, and yet they're not integrated at all in the official transportation system.
Yes, yes. Actually, what's happened over the last few years is that the government refused them to continue practicing their aesthetic and then their colors. And they said all matatus must be painted white.
Oh.
with a yellow line. All matatu drivers and all the conductors, the guys who handle the door and get people in out, the conductors basically should dress in a uniform. I suppose there's some rationale behind this, because it was also like, it's an informal space that actually breeds a lot of things, and they had to identify these people. But it's an interesting way of actually trying to control the space. So they're no longer like as brilliantly colored, which makes Nairobi a little more drab.
Yeah. So how would you say that the literary journal is it opening minds? Is it opening these spaces, or are you in your own narrow channel as well, a different one, maybe not as academic?
We are moving from the narrow channel into other spaces, and that has been because of opening up, moving from like a journal to a small publishing space. I mean, it's not only writers who have the kind of sensibility we are looking for. You can imagine, you have photographers, you have all these interesting people, whether it's stand-up comedians, whether it's musicians, whether it's performance poets, and I think that even if you're running a journal as your primary core business, I mean, all these guys have so much content of its own. And it's very, very important to actually think about how do you open up the space beyond this book, artifact, call it, if you could call it that, into a bigger space where these people with these similar sensibilities are operating from. And I think in that way, we're kind of expanding. We're seen as pretty central with other players, of course. As people who are trying to bring a generational conversation that was absent to the fore.
Billy, great.
I think that's where we are, yeah.
Great to see you again. Thanks for having me, Frank.
Thanks.
Billy Kahora is a writer and managing editor of Kwani, a literary network in Kenya. He works in Nairobi. He is here as part of a seminar at Duke University's Franklin Humanities Institute entitled The Function of the Literary Magazine in the Current Moment. Coming up, Grammy-nominated Nicolay returns with The Hot at Nights live in our studio. Stay with us.